lies, and lobbyists, allegedly in the state capitol. Welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Six women have come forward and claimed one of Tallahassee's most powerful politicians had sexually harassed them. Well, it turns out Tallahassee is awash with harassing behavior. And in some cases, sex is used as a weapon and a tool by lawmakers and lobbyists. Will that impact the upcoming session? Voters in four Miami-Dade municipalities are going to the ballot box today. We'll go over the candidates and the issues. Also, last night, the federal government ended temporary protected status for a couple thousand Nicaraguans. What's that going to mean for tens of thousands of Haitians, Salvadorans, and Hondurans also on TPS? All of that coming up on Sundial here on WLRN. First, the news. Welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Well, today, voters in four different municipalities in Miami-Dade are going to the ballot. A couple of cities will have a new mayor. There will likely be new names in commissioner seats, but more than just new political leaders taking seats, voters are going to be asked about some very big resolutions and bills. Joining us now, WLRN News Director Terrence Shepard, joining us from the Doral Studios at the Miami Herald. He's going to give us an update on what's happening today. Terrence, welcome.
Hey, Lewis. How's it going?
It's going good. All right. So what cities have elections today?
So today, November election, you have only four cities in Dade County. The rest of South Florida has the day off. But Miami-Dade has elections in the city of Miami, Hialeah, Homestead, and Miami Beach.
All right. So you know what? With an election like this, what sort of voter turnout do we tend to see, especially for mayoral races?
You would think turnout would be higher, but traditionally, unless there's a president being decided or a governor or senators, turnout tends to be very low, despite there being a couple of interesting ballot initiatives voters need to decide on today. So turnout is very low. I had a couple of reporters in the field this morning, one reporter in Miami Beach, and she visited six polling places and found zero people voting. She did speak to some of the poll workers, and they say typically in these off-year elections, you see two or three people per hour. So turnout is typically fairly low unless you're voting for the big names, the president, the governor, senator.
All right, let's talk about, we're going to start with Miami Beach. They're going to be choosing a new mayor. Who's running?
So in the Miami Beach mayoral race, you've got four people running now. You've got Dan Gelber, Daniel Kahn, Kenneth Boreski, and June Savage. Dan Gelber's by far has the biggest name recognition. He's a former state legislator and a federal prosecutor. The race became less interesting when Michael Grieco withdrew. So Michael Grieco was a former commissioner who dropped out of the race after he faced campaign finance problems.
And, of course, his commission seat now is going to be open. That's one of the ones that people will also be choosing. Whose seats are changing besides his? What other seats changing besides his?
So there are two Miami Beach commission seats changing. The more interesting issue in Miami Beach, though, is the 2 p.m. liquor ban in South Beach. That ballot initiative is what some people are calling is the battle royal for the soul of South Beach. If that approves, if that's okayed by voters, bars on section of Ocean Drive would need to close at 2 a.m. Proponents are saying this would crush business. It would change the fundamental nature of South Beach. You'd have massive layoffs. You'd have just a diminishment of the clout in the nightlife scene in South Beach. But proponents say that we need to close the bars earlier because it's attracting a certain element that is no longer desirable in the beach.
And, you know, Tom Hudson on the Sunshine Economy covered this issue really nicely, really talking to both sides, you know, discussing what could or could not happen if this does pass. The other issue has to do with redevelopment in part of North Beach. Remind us what that is.
Okay. Redevelopment in North Beach, my computer just froze, Lewis, so please forgive me. I got spotty internet connection and I can't access my notes now.
Okay, all right. Let's do this. When that comes back, you can tell me. Let's talk about the city of Miami. They're also picking a new mayor.
The city of Miami is picking a mayor. So Tomas Regalado is term limited out. However, competing for the Miami mayoral seat are the political dynasties. So the dynasties are competing to fill the seats there. You've got, and computer's frozen again, Lewis. You didn't tell me that we had these problems in Doral.
All right. No, you know what? When we get the computer back up, that's all right. Voters are going to be picking two district seats as well, and they're going to be decide in Miami, the city of Miami. They're going to be voting on a $400 million bond issue that would spend money on things like flood resiliency, affordable housing. Can you elaborate a little bit on this one?
That's a more compelling issue on the ballot. So voters decide to borrow $400 million for the city of Miami to pay for improvements that would improve mitigation at sea level rise, resiliency, affordable housing, a new fire station, and other things. The issue there, some of the opponents, who include many in the environmental community, is they say, yes, we're going to mitigate sea level rise, but they're not at this point saying which projects will be taken on. In fact, as our reporter Kate Stein has reported, there's not much agreement on which portions of Miami would be most at risk of being impacted by sea level rise. So this is basically saying, trust us, we will figure it out when you pass the vote. And as you and I know, that trusting politicians, trusting government officials is something that voters, at least since the Marlins stadium vote, voters have been more and more reluctant to just trust politicians with these type tax issues.
Did you just bring up the Marlins stadium?
Well,
we're going to go back to that, huh? All right.
Sure. I mean, see, this happened in Broward last year. There was a paired ballot initiative in Broward to help transportation and other issues, and they both needed to pass, and they didn't pass because it was basically voters had to say, trust us that we will spend the money in appropriate manners.
All right. And then again, you said the other two cities that are looking at elections today, Hialeah and Homestead.
Sure. Those are Hialeah mayor. Carlos Hernandez is running for reelection. He's expected to win. And there are two council seats open in Hialeah also. But again, these are important for the residents, important for the politically active, but on a day like today, turnout will be extremely low. And we'd be surprised if there are any shocking upsets. But of course, shocking upsets are what have been happening in Florida since Rick Scott won the gubernatorial seat 7 years ago.
All right. I wanted to come back real quickly to the city of Miami mayoral race. So we're talking. You're talking about dynasties. I mean, you're talking about Francis Suarez, who would be running, and he's running against Williams Armbrister Sr., Christian Kanash, I hope I'm saying that right, and Cynthia Mason Jacquith. What can you tell us about Suarez? Because he is the favorite, correct?
Sure. He's the favorite. And again, he's got the name recognition. His dad, Xavier Suarez, was a longtime Miami mayor. Longtime mayor, powerful figure. And so he has been riding on his dad's coattails, although not completely. He's trying to make a name for himself. But in these local elections, Lewis, you see that name recognition matters a lot. It's important. It's important to be out there, to be known. Many people don't study up the way good citizens do, and so you'll vote for the person you're most familiar with.
Yeah, and what is it? Three of the seven candidates for the open District 3 seat on the Board of Commissioners have relatives who currently hold office in Miami or Miami-Dade County. I mean, is that, you know, that kind of goes to some of the history in Miami where really you see families that hold these positions. And as you said, people seem to vote for who they know.
That's right. It's an advantage. I don't have that advantage, Lewis, because my dad is a minister. I don't have politics in my family, so you will not see my name on a ballot. You will not see me in a pulpit either. But that's a fundamental advantage. It goes back to the agrarian society. If your parents were in the farming business, you're a farmer. If your parents are in politics, in Miami particularly, you'll enter politics and you'll likely become successful.
The ballots opened up, the polls, I should say, opened up this morning at 7 o'clock. They will close at 7 p.m. And again, those are elections going on in Miami Beach, the city of Miami, Homestead, and Hialeah. And of course, stay tuned to WLRN. We will keep you updated on the results of those elections. As we mentioned, as Terrence mentioned, that we've got reporters out there on the scene. So we'll get those results when they come in later tonight. Terrence Shepherd, news director at WLRN. Terrence, a pleasure.
Thank you, Lewis.
All right. He's over at the Doral Studios at the Miami Herald. All right. Coming up next, a closer look at the seedy side of politics up in Tallahassee. That's on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, Tallahassee is awash in controversy. One of the state's most powerful politicians could face an investigation for allegations of sexual harassment. Six anonymous sources claim that State Senator Jack Latvala of Clearwater had sexually harassed them over a period of years, touching them inappropriately without their consent and making demeaning remarks about their bodies. Now, since that story, a picture of a Capitol where sex is used by the politically powerful has become more clear. It's not a new story, but it's now being discussed at a time when sexual harassment has become a dominant issue in the national vernacular. Earlier today, we spoke with Mary Ellen Kloss, the Tallahassee bureau chief at the Miami Herald. She was one of three reporters on the recent Miami Herald Tampa Bay Times story on these scandals. The other two were Steve Bosquet and Patty Mazzei. And I talked with Mary Ellen about what was really going on in the Capitol. Mary Ellen, how long have you been covering Tallahassee?
It is almost 30 years.
So when did you first notice that Tallahassee was, quote, different in terms of tolerating relationships and in some cases harassment that just wouldn't be allowed anywhere else?
Well, the remarkable thing is that I noticed it immediately as a young woman coming to Tallahassee. I came in 1988, and back then things were, there was a sense that women were empowered and there were a lot of female legislators, but there were far more male legislators than female, and far more male lobbyists. And so the control and center of power was very male dominated. And of course, when I was recently out of college and definitely thought that this was just the beginning of where things are going to change. What's remarkable is that over 30 years, things have not changed that much. Now, we've seen progress, but the fact that this continues to go on is not surprising to anybody, I'm sure.
You and Steve Bosquet talked to dozens of lawmakers and lobbyists for your recent article. You basically describe a place where sex is currency for lobbyists and lawmakers to make deals. And the most shocking allegation is the idea of closers. Explain what that means.
Well, actually, this is something that has gone on for a very, very long time. Back in the day, before we had text messaging, or lobbyists would have to work really hard to get legislators' attention in the closing days of session when they needed their attention to get amendments to bills, when they wanted things tucked into the budget. And so one of the devices they used was beautiful young women. And in a college town like Tallahassee, there are a lot of available and eager young women who are willing to kind of join in the process, and they get hired for a good sum of money, and they went alongside lobbyists to get lawmakers' attention. Now, that dynamic of needing to communicate with legislators on the floor of the House or Senate has changed a lot, because they now can communicate via text message. But they still use these young women in the final weeks of session, and you can find, and these people come and show up at the bars, and we've heard from quite a number of people that say, you know, there's no holds barred here. The women are, if they want to have a consensual relationship with a legislator in the final weeks, that's fine. And they're available. And I can tell you, I've heard a lot of stories that I could never repeat on the air, but it's also because they're rumors. But what I've heard is pretty unsettling.
Let's be clear. These are lobbyists or employees of lobbying firms. I mean, to be blunt, we're not talking about escorts, right?
No. We're not talking about escorts. They're hired by firms.
What about on the state house side? Did sources tell you about the exploitation of staffers as well, or interns?
Absolutely. The dynamic has been around for a long time, where, you know, you've got eager young people, eager to get into the process. And really, being a legislative aide or an intern is a great experience. It's an opportunity to kind of see things from the ground level. And I just hope that the idea that this has become sort of a sexual predator ground doesn't interfere with a lot of young people who are ambitious. But I also have watched, it's not just me, but I've heard and watched it, the process where they hire women. You know, it's only a handful of them, but pretty much many people in Tallahassee can identify who they are. They hire women that they have met at a cocktail lounge in Tallahassee and said, "We've got an opening on my staff. Would you like to be my intern?" And then, you know, I wrote earlier in the year about how some legislators, these interns then appear, you know, on the payroll of their political committee and, you know, show up as a political consultant. So there is the questions about how legitimate is this, what is the real experience involved, and how many people are actually abusing the opportunity here so that they can have these good-looking young women close to them.
All right, you talked about in some cases, there are consensual relationships, but do you think of any of this as criminal behavior?
I'm not going to be the one that decides this, but I have talked to many who say, if you make somebody available for sex, that is criminal. Now, I don't think it's ever quite that clear, but I have not been engaged in watching these conversations as they transpire. You know, the rumors are pretty astounding, and they're everywhere. So the idea that somebody will, a lobbyist, will get their bill heard or get their amendment added in return for, you know, something that's out there. It's more than just sexual harassment, but when it gets to the point of, you know, the physical contact, that is sexual assault, and sexual assault is criminal. And Senate President Joe Negron, when he read the Politico Florida story last week, he basically said he's going to do an investigation into sexual assault, sexual harassment, and verbal sexual misconduct.
And so, that story that you're talking about is about State Senator Jack Latvala. Now, the leaders,
that's right.
Yeah, the leaders of the House and Senate have condemned, obviously, this kind of behavior. They say they're not going to tolerate it. And then you talk about Joe Negron. He had made changes in reporting harassment that some people think might actually make it harder to report. Explain what he did.
Well, this is a really interesting development, because before the Jack Latvala allegations emerged, the Senate president's staff announced a change in the way they were going to handle any sexual harassment allegations. And instead of letting it go to the office that is jointly run by the House and the Senate, it's the Human Resources Office, they were going to have the complaints be centered in the Senate President's office. When that came out, it really appeared as if he was trying to control who got this information. And in that, it raised doubts about how independent he would be if somebody came with a complaint. So shortly after that pushback and about the process, he was forced to clarify and say that, no, the goal here is not to limit the number of people who can receive complaints. It's actually designed to broaden it. So he made it clear that somebody could come to anyone in the Senate President's office, but they could also go to the Human Resources Office of the House and Senate. It still does raise some questions about why that change was made.
Mary Ellen, legislators have been term limited for quite some time in Tallahassee. When those limits went into effect, some people predicted that it would mean lobbyists would come to control the culture of the Capitol because they're the ones who stay, while the senators and representatives have to leave after a few years. Do you think that's a factor in this at all?
Many of the old timers indicate that, yes, that is, because there is this pressure on people when they get to the get elected to the legislature to make a name for themselves and identify themselves as someone with power and clout. And the way that is the way that you can show that you have power and clout is if you're good at fundraising. And of course, lobbyists control often the clients that can steer money into your political committee. So having a good relationship with a lobbyist makes a big difference. And so that is, many people do think that term limits have contributed to sort of this amped up idea that lobbyists want to get attention and legislators are sort of feeding on what they can offer.
Look, this with the scandals that you had reported and you said there are things you can't even mention. Look, this is nothing new, right? You talked about the fact that there were incidents going back to the 60s.
That's right. And, that is the important thing is this is a like every capital in this country, like Washington, D.C., you've got a power dynamic and the people in power can exploit it. And you know, when you overlay that with the need for political enemies and political motives, you can get people to be quiet about things that normally might surface, and that is why there has been sort of this code of silence. And you're right, back in the 60s they had something called the trailers, where they were the manufacturing housing industry. It brought people legislators out there. They wined and dined them, and they had a lot of women there too. And the reputation is that sex was free and wild. And then we've had numerous examples ever since then of, rarely do things reach the surface in a tense and viable way. There have been a few examples. We had a case in the early 90s where a state legislator and a House member from Broward, Fred Lippman, was accused of harassing his aide. And they actually settled that case. And then once the settlement came out, there was a hearing. It's not new. The question is, what is going on that we don't know, and how much is really happening behind the scenes, and what opportunity is there for somebody who has negative, violent, or even, uncomfortable sexual harassment experience? What opportunity do they have to raise that and do anything about it, or is the code of silence keeping that quiet as well?
No, what I thought was interesting too is the fact that in your article you described, this general atmosphere of harassment where men just felt free to comment on women's appearances and bodies, and you even quoted some female legislators talking about that.
Oh, absolutely. Female legislators have to, they have to earn their respect. There's also an attitude that it's okay to comment on people's bodies, and as if that's just, we're not even going to, there's nothing offensive about that. And I've talked to women lobbyists who've absolutely had to deal with that on a regular basis. And one of the biggest fears that I have about all this attention right now is that there may be an as they try to correct this, the victims of this may actually once again be women, because women legislators, women lobbyists who don't want to come up here and talk about unfairly influencing the process with sex, they want to talk about policy. How are they being perceived now? Are they automatically going to be, are male legislators in power going to now see them as women who they should stay away from? I think we've got a new dynamic that makes that that raises that question.
That was Mary Ellen Kloss, Tallahassee Bureau Chief at the Miami Herald. We were talking about a recent story published by the Miami Herald and the Tampa Bay Times looking at sex scandals in Tallahassee. We'll continue the conversation in just a moment here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Earlier today, I spoke with Mary Ellen Claus, Tallahassee bureau chief at the Miami Herald. She was one of three reporters on a recent Miami Herald-Tampa Bay Times story on sex scandals at the state capitol. The other reporters were Steve Bosquet and Patty Mazzei. Mary Ellen, you describe this world not so much of just harassment, but a kind of very loose atmosphere with lots of people having affairs, and it's commonly known that they are. And you have this amazing quote from a legislator who said that the attitude there just seems to be that Tallahassee is for mistresses and home is for the wives.
That's right, and that does seem to be the perception by a lot of people. I think that this particular legislator was very concerned when he came to Tallahassee and he saw the amount of extramarital affairs and flings that were happening. Some people are surprised by that. And as we've mentioned, this is something that's happened for a long time in Tallahassee. It does raise the question about conflicts and conflicts. Do these relationships breed unfair advantage for the lobbyists that get involved? Does it result in conflicts if it's between two legislators? And when that is when that doesn't surface, the public has no way to know what those conflicts are.
Sorry, so wait a minute. All of this is happening. We've known this stuff like this has been happening for decades. Why do you think this is all coming out now?
Well, I think there is now there's two things here. We've got sexual harassment and the attention that everything from Bill O'Reilly and Harvey Weinstein, what that has done to the national dialogue on sexual harassment. Then we've got the other thing, and that is this idea that we've got relationships and consensual sex, but it's often infidelity and you know, it's relationships between lobbyists or between lobbyists and legislators or legislators amongst each other. So there is this perception that I think there's a good argument to be made that if you are having sex with a subordinate, that is sexual harassment because you're using power over someone. And the House Speaker has, and their new rules have identified harassment over a subordinate to include lobbyists. Now, there are some people in Tallahassee that say, actually, that's not a fair equation because there are very powerful lobbyists that actually have more power over member legislators, who, especially if they're in need of campaign contributions, that kind of thing. So it mucks it. It's controversial. It's a very muddy situation, and part of this is why none of this has surfaced. There are so many people who have maybe something they don't want to come out into the open that they want to hold each other's secrets, and the more that people can do to make sure that nobody knows what the other person is doing. If you share my secret, I'll keep yours. That pact is definitely a something that is bipartisan.
That goes into the code of silence. It's a scratch my back, I'll scratch yours type thing.
Right.
Okay. Well, you know, we've seen a couple of very powerful senators now caught up in this. The first was Senator Jeff Clemons. He was in line to become Senate Minority Leader. Remind us quickly what happened to him.
Senator Jeff Clemons was a week away from being designated as the incoming Democratic leader when Politico Florida got allegations and that he had an extramarital affair with a young lobbyist. They did not have the lobbyist on the record, but they got Clemons to apologize for the relationship. That is how they frame their story. And once he apologized, then the pressure was on. Within a day, he decided to, he's married, and apparently he had told his wife about this, and they'd allegedly been talking about it and working on it over the past few months. But there were other possible things that might have come out about Jeff Clemons' behavior in Tallahassee, and I think to avoid that, he stepped down and resigned his position.
And the other one, of course, is Senator Jack Latvala, the political story that came out on Friday, claiming that six different women were claiming sexual harassment, that he had touched them, you know, without their consent, that he had made all kinds of demeaning comments about their bodies. He was removed temporarily from a very high position, but there is supposed to be an investigation on him. What's going on right now?
Well, Senate President Joe Negron has indicated that he is in search of a third party to handle the investigation. We don't know. He said they're interviewing various people and that they will have an announcement sometime this week as to who they will choose for that. There's a lot of questions about this because the way Joe Negron handles this is going to depend on how much, how comfortable the alleged accusers will have to come forward. If, you know, initially Senate President Negron indicated that he wanted everything to kind of be under the control of the Senate. Well, Jack Latvala is a very powerful member of the Senate. He also is running for governor and has a $6 million political committee at his that he has access to. And I think there is a great fear among people who, you know, understand this process that whatever happens, these people, these women that come forward have to absolutely feel as if there is no chance that there would be any opportunity for retribution. And that is the only way for a fair investigation to occur. And it really has, Joe Negron has to be sure that the Senate will not have its hands in this in any way.
And just to make sure, but coming back to Senator Latvala, has he announced?
Yes. Yeah, he has announced that he's running for governor. Now, the one who hasn't announced is House Speaker Richard Corcoran.
Who's a big critic of Latvala.
He is a very big critic, and there are many in Tallahassee, and even Latvala especially, has fingered Corcoran as probably the source of a lot of these allegations, and he's suggested that Corcoran has been responsible for encouraging people to make these, what Latvala has said are false and absolutely false allegations, and his supporters seem to believe that there is no way that anybody will come forward because they're not confident that there is truth behind these allegations.
What's changed in Tallahassee in light of everything that's happened these last couple of weeks? I mean, what's the feeling right now?
The feeling is one of paranoia that anybody who has any kind of, you know, problem in their past could either come out and there's a lot of fear that there may be the opportunity for people to falsely accuse legislators as well, that this stuff is so potent and so powerful that it can ruin careers in a flash, and so people are very, very worried. Somebody basically say that they've become afraid of talking to the media, that they're looking around their shoulder, across their shoulder, behind them, over their shoulder constantly, because they are afraid that the media is out sort of headhunting.
And you talk about this paranoia. There was a part of the story, too, in all of this with the Senator Latvala, and also, again, in your story, looking into, really the environment in the Capitol. But a bizarre part of the story, it was a condominium where lawmakers stay, and someone had found hidden cameras?
Yes.
What was that all about?
So there, at the last week of the legislative session last year, Senator Oscar Brainin, there's a couple condominiums in Tallahassee that are many legislators live in them because they're part-time residents and it's very convenient. They're close to the Capitol. So on one of these floors, there were a number of legislators and a couple lobbyists, and Senator Oscar Brainin from Miami found a camera sitting on a table right near the elevator, and it was very suspicious. And the reason he had this sense of suspicion is that just a week before, Senator Frank Artiles had resigned under fire and had told many, many people that he was going to get even, and that in retribution for his fall, he was going to get the dirt on everybody else.
Do we know where the cameras came from?
The camera was the property of a private investigator, and we do not know who hired the private investigator. FDLE did investigate. They concluded that as a private eye, he had an absolute right to put cameras in a public area and do surveillance.
And there's no reason to believe that this has anything to do with Artiles.
There is no evidence that this has to do with Artiles, but there is this sense of paranoia that maybe Artiles was hiring people, but no one knows. And he has not been willing to come forward and clear the record on that.
With all of this going on, is anyone going to be able to do any work? We have the session coming up in January.
Right. It is going to be a very difficult session. First of all, we have, if there was any trust between the House and the Senate, that has just been demolished. There is a sense that there are people who are sort of the morality police in the House, and that they're eager to go after the behavior of senators. On the other hand, you do have these very serious allegations, and if these continue to emerge, and it does, there is the possibility that if the investigation that Senator Negron does of Jack Latvala is done right, that would shield anybody from coming forward with allegations. So it doesn't have to just necessarily target Jack Latvala. So there is this premise that everybody is just walking on eggshells right now, and the idea that anything, this is as we enter probably the widest open election year in Florida, because the governor, the cabinet, and all the domino effect those races have, there's going to be so much election energy already, that the idea we're going to get anything substantial done this session is very unlikely.
Yeah, you also pointed out, too, that, you know, we're seeing similar stories and similar scandals in California, Kentucky, Illinois, Massachusetts. So the issue of sexual harassment and this sexual misbehavior is really now just becoming part of the national vernacular. What do you sense is happening, that people are finally starting to come forward? They're finally starting to tell these stories?
What's been very interesting is that the people that are coming forward in some of these other states, and I have looked a little bit at how this has happened, are they've in California and Illinois, it's women lobbyists and legislators have banded together and basically started telling their stories, and it's sort of the unity of a group. In other places like Kentucky, The word has leaked out that there was a sexual harassment settlement against the Kentucky House Speaker, so he has resigned his post as Speaker, although he hasn't resigned his position as a legislator. There is sort of now an opportunity for women to sort of feel safe, because this conversation, people get it, people are understanding the ramifications of it, and I am not sure we've reached that point in Florida. There's been several days. No one has come forward. No one is willing to put their name behind any allegations. And if there have been settlements that, you know, have happened, they still have not surfaced. And usually they have non-disclosure clauses and those kinds of things. So there's always that legal hurdle. But in other places, they've still come out. They've emerged.
That was Mary Ellen Kloss, Tallahassee bureau chief at the Miami Herald. Was talking with her from the Doral studios at the Miami Herald earlier this morning. We will have a link up on our website at WLRN.org, a little bit with a link from her story. And again, looking at really how business is done in Tallahassee. And again, still the sexual harassment claims against Senator Jack Latvala that are likely to be investigated. Again, he is denying all allegations. All right, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about the announcement that came down yesterday from the Department of Homeland Security on TPS for Nicaraguans. That's coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. If you tuned into the program yesterday, we spoke with the Catholic Legal Services about the potential announcement by the Department of Homeland Security on the TPS status of Hondurans and Nicaraguans. Well, last night, DHS announced that it was ending temporary protected status for a couple thousand Nicaraguans living in the U.S. under that protection. They will now have until January 5th of 2019 to make arrangements for some other form of legal residency, or they must leave. DHS did not make a determination about the fate of Hondurans with TPS. They're going to get an extension until July of next year. That, of course, means we still also have almost a 250,000 Salvadorans and Haitians still awaiting their TPS fate. Joining us now, WLRN's America's correspondent, Tim Padgett. Welcome back.
Thank you.
All right. So what does this mean? I mean, for the Nicaraguans, they have almost a year.
Right. More than a year, actually.
A little more than a year.
Yeah, it's supposed to end. Their temporary protected status is supposed to end in January of 2019. So that gives them more than a year, really, to wait and see if Congress can finally come up with some solution to this problem for groups like theirs, particularly in the form of legislation like the one that Carlos Curbelo and the South Florida congressional delegation has recently introduced, called the here we go, the Extending Status Protection for Eligible Refugees with Established Residency Act.
All right.
Now, that would give groups like the Nicaraguans who have temporary protected status but are facing its termination a chance to get on the path to legal residency.
And so a little over a year, they can wait for Congress, or what other option would they have besides leaving? I mean, if they wanted to try to stay.
For the Nicaraguans, that congressional bill seems to be really their only option. I think the Trump administration has decided that that's it for the Nicaraguans. They first got their temporary protected status after the 1998 awful hurricane, Hurricane Mitch. And that was a very good reason to give people, because Nicaragua, particularly rural Nicaragua, was simply devastated after that.
And the federal government's convinced that things are now fine, you can go back?
Yeah, that's the ironic thing. You've got a very conservative administration here saying that things are looking pretty good in a country run by one of its left-wing nemesis, Daniel Ortega, the Sandinista president of Nicaragua. But the fact is, under Daniel Ortega, the economy is looking good compared to others in Central America. And more important, security looks much more positive in Nicaragua than it does in places like neighboring Honduras and El Salvador, which have some of the worst homicide rates in the world.
And why do you think they decided to extend it for Hondurans right now?
Because, as I just said, some of the worst homicide rates in the world. Honduras is an appallingly violent country right now, still, even though things have improved there. And not only is it violent, you've got a lot of Hondurans here under temporary protected status who would be the kind of people who, if they were to go back, they would be targets of the gangs known as the Maras. Oftentimes, these Hondurans were escaping Honduras because they had been targeted by Maras who either wanted them to join their group and or who were extorting their families, etc. So it's a very dicey situation for Hondurans in particular, and Salvadorans who face the same situation if they were to go back.
And so you have Salvadorans, Hondurans, and of course Haitians with
right.
TPS protective status, and they're waiting to see what can they gather from what happened with this decision yesterday.
Well, I think the Haitians are hoping that they too will receive some sort of similar extension like what the Hondurans received. Their TPS is supposed to run out in January, and they're hoping that maybe they can get another 6-month extension into the summer. President Trump and his administration are supposed to decide on this by later this month. So it's going to be real tense here as people await to see if President Trump decides to backtrack on his administration's earlier pledge this year to terminate TPS for Haitians definitely in January.
What happens? I think about the folks who, because like with Nicaraguans, they've been here a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And in that time, obviously, they've established themselves in a community. Some of them may have businesses. I mean, you have property, you have businesses.
Yeah.
You have to just leave that?
That's one of the, obviously, the big criticisms of not only of the Trump administration's decision to try to eliminate TPS, but also of the people who created TPS back in the 1990s in the first place. This was so open-ended. This was so not very well thought out in terms of the long term. A lot of people said it shouldn't be called TPS. It should be called something like IPS. It should have been called indefinite protected status, so that when we did come to a point where people have been living here for 10, 20 years, we wouldn't arrive at this point where we say, oh, by the way, now, you know, you've got to go back. When, in fact, they're very entrenched in their communities. They own businesses. And most important, they're sending billions of dollars of remittances back to those countries, which those countries often depend on to become the kind of better countries that we want them to become, so that we're not receiving so many immigrants from them.
Where, by the way, I mean, again, it's a couple of thousand Nicaraguans.
Right.
Where are they living right now, most of them?
Assume to be living here in South Florida. South Florida has the largest Nicaraguan community in the United States. There are about 125,000 Nicaraguan Americans here in South Florida, and that's by far the largest community.
And my understanding, a lot of Hondurans live actually further north. They live up in around the D.C. area?
That's Salvadorans.
Salvadorans, excuse me.
Hondurans are scattered around the country, too. We have a very large Honduran community here, particularly in Broward County. But Hondurans, places like New Orleans, for example, and Los Angeles, very large communities there. But again, a very large community here.
And if you had children born in the United States, how does that change your fate?
That's another thing we're going to have to see. I mean, family separation is also a very big issue here. And I think that's one of the reasons that the Trump administration went ahead and ended it for Nicaraguans, because you are talking about a relatively small number of people, only maybe as many as 2,500 compared to 50,000 Haitians, 200,000 Salvadorans, 60,000 Hondurans, etc. I think they felt it was politically safe to go ahead and say, we're going to cut this off for Nicaraguans because it's not going to have as devastating an effect.
I remember when during the campaign, President Trump at the time, campaigning, was here in South Florida and spoke to the Haitian community.
Right.
Again, making these promises to them that I'm going to be the best for you. I mean, what happens now? Do you think that any of that is going to influence his decision, when it comes to Haitian TPS?
Well, I think what President Trump would like is for him not to have to make, really, the decision. He's been sort of pushing, just like he did with the DREAM Act earlier this fall. He's kind of punting it to Congress. He's sort of telling Congress, look, we don't want to do this. We don't want to uproot these people. But, this is a bad program. Temporary protected status has become permanent protected status. That's not what my political base wants. So he's telling Congress, look, come up with some sort of solution here to this. And maybe it's in the form of the bill that Carlos Curbelo and the South Florida delegation are proposing to give these people legal residency. But really, he's just sort of punting it to them, I think, at this point.
Does that bill have a chance, or how's it doing?
It's wending its way through, to committee, et cetera. I think it all depends on, for example, whether we see in any sort of positive movement toward the DREAM Act, for example, giving those, people, those people who came here as children, and there's a big, there's a big, a lot of support in the United States for giving those people legal residency. But so far, we haven't really seen much, traction in Congress on that. So I'm worried, a lot of people are worried that, this bill of Curbelo's, et cetera, might not get that much traction either.
Again, the decision, at least for some folks on TPS protection, coming up within the next few months. So America's correspondent, Tim Padgett, joining us now. Thanks so much, Tim.
Thank you.
And that is our program. Thank you so much for tuning in. Find us on Facebook, WLRN Sundial, or our Twitter handle is at WLRN Sundial. Our producer is Maeve McGoran, and Polly Landis. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre, and Teresa Frontado is our digital director. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's program director is Peter Meritz, and our technical supervisor is Jason Zapka. Again, I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for tuning in. We'll talk again tomorrow.